65 and 87 years, many of them have been playing jazz since the 1940s and have seen the world transform. From the Japanese occupation and the Cultural Revolution to capitalism on overdrive, the band members have seen the many faces of China and withstood government's suspicion of jazz. Again, that's As Time Goes By in Shanghai, Thursday, May 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the May 21st performance of Lalgudi Krishnan and Shahid Parvez at the First Baptist Church in Portland at 7 p.m. Lalgudi Krishnan began his musical training at age 5, and over the years he has carved a niche for himself as a top-ranking violinist. Shahid Parvez descends from 6 generations of sitarists and is the recipient of numerous prestigious awards, including the Government of India's Padma Shri. Again, that's Lalgudi Krishnan and Shahid Parvez, Saturday, May 21st at 7 p.m. at the First Baptist Church, located at 909 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO, your community radio station in Portland, Oregon. Today is Monday, May 16th, 2016, and the time is approximately 8 a.m. This is More Talk Radio, and my name is Cecil Prescott, and I will be joined by my co-host, Celeste Carey. So tomorrow is the date in which ballots are supposed to be returned in Oregon. So those of you who are in Oregon, I hope you have prepared your ballots and have turned them in. So we're going to be talking with a very interesting guest this morning, Mark Gerson, who is a author and president and founder of an organization called Mediators Foundation. His most recent book is The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. In researching Mark and this topic, I thought I would share with you a few remarks that you might find interesting about political candidates. So those of you who are turned off by what is potentially a very heated and divisive campaign, just listen to some of the remarks from the first contested presidential election. So one candidate supporter called the other candidate a fraud, a coward, a thief, and a mean-spirited, low-life fellow, the son of a half-breed Indian squaw, sired by a Virginia mulatto father. He won. Before he won, Thomas Jefferson, he called his opponent a hideous hermaphrodite character, which has neither the force and firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. Great God of compassion and justice, shield my country from destruction. Adam seemed to have passed this trait on to his son, who in 1828, when running for re-election against Andrew Jackson, John Quincy Adam and his handler said that Jackson had a personality of a dictator who was too uneducated to be president, and even hurled all sorts of insults to Jackson's wife, Rachel. Now, Jackson's wife, Rachel, had been in an abusive marriage and finally was divorced from her husband, but divorce was a scandal in those days. So some of Adam's followers called her a dirty black wench, a convicted adulteress who was prone to open and notorious lewdness. Well, Jackson people were not going to sit back and have that insult, so they said that Adam had sold his wife's maid as a concubine to the Tsar of Russia.
But that wasn't particularly a powerful, you know, slur there.
Just something about who we are as a nation. Hoping to give us some information and light and about this campaign and his vision about how we shall transform our nations and how we do political debate is Mark Gertson. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Cecil. Nice to be with you and Celeste.
Good morning. So I want to start out by quoting something out of your preface here. We Americans are solving problems and achieving positive results, not despite but because of our differences. Many of our fellow citizens are living evidence of this third story, and that they are putting country before party. They're drawing the outlines of a new political map that connects us rather than divides us. They are forming networks and organizations that are building bridges rather than walls, and they are bridging the partisan divide in living rooms and in communities, in state legislatures, and on Capitol Hill. Now, these are part of the stories that you kind of outline in the preface, but given Cecil's introduction and some of the news that we're hearing, just a brief comparison and contrast, if you will, of how your enthusiasm and your vision plays out.
Well, I think what Cecil's preface there from the early founders of the country and some of their the invective they hurled at each other. Obviously, we've been arguing and speaking in angry and sort of in caustic ways for our entire history as a country. I think what's different is that today the media are quite different than they were in Andrew Jackson or Thomas Jefferson's day.
Oh, definitely.
And people spend far, far, far more time in the media universe and far less time in what I would call the human universe, mm-hmm. just with people in their own communities, their own farms, their own villages. And I think the question is, what's the reason that most of your listeners have never heard about all these Americans that I describe in the book is that we are continually hearing about Donald Trump's tweets or Hillary's emails, mm-hmm. and we don't hear about all the people who are in Portland and other places around the country who are working every day with Democrats, Republicans, and Independents to get things done. And all those people doing that work across the divide to keep cities running or schools running or hospitals running or solve problems even in the political sphere, they're in the state legislature, they get really very little political coverage because what news is there in people working together? So I think we are paying the price for a media that is fascinated by conflict and bored by collaborative problem solving.
And then in characterizing the media, so I would take the bold step and just say that's corporate and commercial media as opposed to independent
exactly.
media or grassroots media.
Exactly. And one of the reasons I love shows like yours is that you're trying to bring a fresh voice and a fair playing field to people to actually have conversations.
So perhaps you can begin to tell us what was your moment when you saw the light. Tell us something about your history and how you felt called, if I may use such a bold term, to talk about transformational ways of doing politics?
Well, I think it goes pretty far back for me, Cecil. It goes as far back as the Vietnam War, when I saw some of my friends run away to Canada to avoid the war, and I saw other of my friends, you know, go to Vietnam and fight, and I felt our generation be divided right down the middle by a war that many people thought shouldn't be fought. And many years later, the man who waged that war, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, basically said, gee, I'm sorry, that was a big mistake. So, you know, I from my teenage years on, I was aware of the fact that, you know, we make bad decisions when we're not when we're not working together. And we just made bad decisions for the last 15 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, to me, the most moral issue that I can bring to the show today is that, you know, when we send young men and women to war, they should be going to serve their country, not serve some political party that's trying to win points or impress people or win the next election. And as you can see from the debate today, I mean, we're still arguing about Iraq and Afghanistan. And I just feel such pain in my heart for the fathers and mothers who've lost sons and daughters in that war. And they've got to ask themselves, what did my son or daughter die for? When Obama calls it a bad war or a good war, and they're fighting about whether it was worth doing or not, I mean, that's no way to run. That's no way to risk, you know, young people's lives. So to me, this is a moral issue more than a political issue, and I've been watching it my whole life, and I think it continues to this day. And I think that's where my passion comes from. My personal background includes working with the United States Congress. I designed the retreats for the U.S. Congress in 1997 and 1999, which sounds a long time ago, but it's actually pretty recently in terms of Congress's history. And what I experienced then, because I worked for Democrats and Republicans, what I experienced was that they're often very good people in that institution. But the way it's structured, it brings out the worst in them. And that means that they make the worst decisions for us and for our country. And I think we deserve better.
So is part of the solution a way of bringing people together? My understanding now is that you mentioned Congress, that it is very divided, maybe more so in many ways, in that the type of interactions that you have, that you participated and helped create, do not take place in at all, if so, only in a very small way. So we don't even, you know, we hear stories of how Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, you know, after a heated debate, you know, used to have cocktails in the evening. My understanding that Congress does not operate that way any longer.
That's correct. I mean, they used to live in Washington, and when they were before the era of, you know, constant airplane flights and easy airplane flights to almost everywhere in America, they used to live in Washington and get to know each other on the weekends. And their families often lived in Washington, and they actually, you know, were a community on Capitol Hill and learned to get to know each other. Between air travel plus then the instructions they received in the 1990s, you know, Newt Gingrich, who was then the party leader in the House, said basically, don't stay in Washington. Go home and keep your districts, you know, behind you. Go back home and spend time in your districts. Just be here Tuesday to Thursday. So that was a major shift, and it's no longer a community. And, of course, in the early days, when you were reading back about Adams and Jefferson, you know, these folks took their horses and their buggies, and they went to Washington, and they lived in Washington while they were, you know, serving in Congress. They lived together. They ate at the same, you know, boarding houses, and they sometimes took walks together and had a drink in the evening. They were literally there, because you couldn't take your horse back and forth between Boston and Washington every weekend. You had to stay put. So it's a very, very different world, and something that I really feel strongly about and talk about in the United States of America is that, you know, the founding fathers, they can't offer us guidance on nuclear weapons. They can't offer us guidance on sexting. They can't offer us guidance on, how to deal with Islamic terrorism. They can't offer us guidance on outsourcing jobs to China. All these issues I just mentioned did not exist in 1776. And so we seem to have forgotten that Jefferson said every generation needs to reinvent democracy. So when these folks say, oh, let's go back to the Constitution and see what the Constitution tells us about how to handle this issue of, you know, let's say transgender bathrooms, Well, the Constitution is not going to tell us a lot about transgender bathrooms, you know. It's just not going to do that. And it's not going to tell us a lot about internet privacy, you know. So we have to become learners and have to work together to learn how to solve the problems we face, just like the Founding Fathers had to solve the problems of 200 years ago.
You know, I do want to say one thing about that, that it doesn't give us the knowledge or the specific insight to address some of these modern problems. One of the things that, whether it be heartfelt and sincere or totally feigned for the moment, there was an attitude that civility and gentility were absolute paramount, despite calling some horrendous names. And so you had people who would, again, whether they meant it or not, spend their energy at least trying to be as civil as they could be toward each other. And then when you have partisan people coming together, one of the things that I noted was a desire for knowledge, a desire to find a way to make things work that we don't seem to want anymore in relation to one-upmanship or extreme partisanship or extreme tunnel vision and myopia. It's more like, okay, I know I could be civilized. I know I'm supposed to have been a well-studied and academically sound person, but it seems more expedient to the moment that I say that, you know, you are, you know, some kind of bottom dweller and bottom feeder and focus on just what my people need instead of figuring out how can we make this work together and strengthen the country. And so when I hear you say that, I'm wondering, well, maybe just living together, spending time with each other, was the answer.
Well, it definitely created a relationship other than that on the floor of the House of Representatives. And I think we all know that you know, if you get along well at work, you're lucky. But it helps to take, you know, have a drink after work from time to time, particularly if you have a conflict. And I personally experienced, Celeste, I would take members of the House and Senate or their chiefs of staff off-site for workshops, and they would learn how to dialogue and work through problems together. And they would do this very successfully if we took them off-site to West Virginia for a weekend retreat, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And we would think, okay, well, they've made great progress on this issue. They know how to work together now. They're going to really make progress. But then I'd ask them a week later, well, how was it when you went back to Capitol Hill after the workshop? And they said, oh, we went back and wanted to share with the party leaders, you know, the breakthroughs we had, and they basically said, no, you can't work with them. You can't work across the aisle like that. We need to use that issue to gain advantage in the next election, and we're not interested in what you learned there. We're interested in making sure it serves our party's interests to position ourselves against them on that issue. So what I learned is that it's, the institution is not actually set up to give us the best outcomes. The institution is set up now for one party to gain advantage over the other. And, you know, that over many, many years, Celeste, has created this lose-lose situation where, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people who are listening to your show right now have a candidate that they, you know, would like to see win in November. And so do I. You know, we all have our preferences. But I think what I learned from all my research for the United States of America is that, you know, I would say 20% of our future depends on who gets elected in November. And 80% of our future depends on how the person who wins and the folks who win and the folks who lose get along afterwards. Because we've seen with 8 years of Obama and 8 years of George Bush that, you know, they can't accomplish a lot if they're being sandbagged by the other side. And Obama was certainly sandbagged by the right, and often George Bush was, you know, detested by the left. And there's just a lot you can't accomplish when you're at each other's throats.
For sure.
We're speaking with Mark Goodson, author of The Reunited States of America and How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And speaking about the political divide, in your book, The Reunited States of America, you not only examine and offer a critique, but you offer examples of how these conversations and dialogues and indeed communities can work together. Tell us a little bit about how you came to write the book, and more particular, highlighting these communities where something new is happening.
Well, I that's a great question, and I think what inspired me was, you know, we all have our heroes, you know, and I think for some people, you know, Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton's a hero. For other people, you know, Donald Trump might be a hero. For me, the heroes are the people who work across the divide. For me, the heroes are people like Joan Blades, who started MoveOn.org, an organization that, you know, mobilized millions of people on the left. And after 5 or 10 years of doing MoveOn.org, Joan realized that mobilizing the left, you know, while a useful thing to do, wasn't actually going to solve problems, because she noticed that there were people like her on the right who were mobilizing the right. And she realized, okay, I've got to do something different. So she became what we call a transpartisan, and she started the Living Room Conversations Project, which now across the country brings people together and gives people a model for how to bring your neighbors over and across the divide have conversations in your living room. Well, now, Joan Blades is known more for MoveOn.org than she is for Living Room Conversations, but I think Living Room Conversations is a great project. And, you know, that's just at the living room level. But, you know, at the state legislature level, my colleagues at the Next Generation Project, which is part of the National Institute of Civil Discourse, they're working in more than a dozen state legislatures, taking state legislators off-site, you know, taking them on retreats to work together to say, hey, you know, we're all state legislators here. Let's see if there's some way, by telling our stories about why we got in politics and what our core values are, we can come back to the state capitol and work more effectively. So I think what they're doing on the state legislature level is absolutely fantastic. And I've got examples like that, Cecil, from all over the country at every level. And they're in towns and cities, including Portland. And, you know, right in Portland, you know, you have at, you know, Portland State University, you've got a great project, you know, under the Consensus Institute, under the work of Wendy Willis, that's a pioneer in policy consensus. It's called the Policy Consensus Institute, and they specialize in bringing political leaders together to solve tough problems. And, you know, I could make the list longer and longer, but the thing they all have in common is that almost none of them can point to media stories that show what they're doing, because it's about people getting along, not about people fighting.
It's not bleeding enough. It's not bleeding enough. And so, therefore, commercial and corporate media don't really, they won't emphasize it. Pretty much the same complaints we're hearing now. We do want to invite your calls, your conversations, especially if you have stories about being a hyper-partisan. And particularly, I'd love to hear from young people who are looking to bridge this gap and create more of a united dialogue, if nothing else. If not a united political force, at least a united dialogue. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And we're looking at our engineer. Are we good to go? Okay. Good morning, George. You're on the air.
Good morning, Celeste. And I just think it's great to have someone with this kind of in-depth, long-term experience to give us some sense of what he has learned, and I just have a question for him and for you, and I sure don't know the answer, but I would like to know, do we all recognize that both political parties are heavily influenced by one of the great, perhaps the great force on the globe, the greatest force, perhaps, which has dominion over the entire globe, almost all of it, and especially of our country? The force of capital and investment, whichever political party is in office, the investors seem to have prepared and engineered to get what they want from that party, and the party that's out of power, they are busy making sure that at some time it will get in power with their help, and that when it does, they will get the returns on their investments. And I'm wondering, if you and your wonderful guest could comment on this, is there some way out of this that he sees, or is this not as important an issue as it appears to me? And so I'll hang up and I'll listen. I'm very interested to hear what you guys have to say.
Mark?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, great question. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's something that I discuss a lot in the United States of America, because we were talking earlier about how things have changed since the Founding Fathers' days. And one of the ways they've changed is that, you know, as my congressman said, you know, one of the first requirements for becoming president of the United States today is $1 billion. If you can't raise $1 billion, don't even think about trying to be president of the United States. And we obviously see that today. So I think your caller is absolutely right. And a lot of the organizations that I profile in my book are actually working on this issue. And it's an extremely divisive issue because, you know, on one level, because Citizens United has made it look like, you know, there's a whole group of people who want corporations to be able to give as much money as they want to candidates. It looks like that's part of, you know, the public is divided. But if you look closely at political polling, you'll find out that the American people actually aren't that divided. And the American people think it's an outrage that it requires billions of dollars to be elected to office. They think it's an outrage, and they have different solutions. But I profile in my book a number of organizations that are working together across the divide, and I'm meeting in New York with some of them, because we feel that if liberals and conservatives can get together on this issue and say we all want to return to a period of time when you don't need millions and millions of dollars to become a public servant. But the hard part about that is that, you know, it's being exploited now by both parties. And the point I made earlier about, you know, you take people off site, they can solve a problem, you let them go back to Capitol Hill and they start arguing again.
Yes.
That's happened with campaign finance reform. And we've got to find a way, and it's up to us. It's up to us, we the people, to really say to our candidates, you know, we want to elect someone to office who's willing to take a stand against the way money has corrupted politics in both parties. And I think it's true. Your caller is right. You know, although I happen to be a progressive and more of a Democrat than a Republican, it's very clear to me that money has corrupted the left as well as the right.
Well, thank you for your call, George. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Michael.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I want to recommend the work of a social psychologist named Jonathan Haidt, that's H-A-I-D-T, who works on something he calls moral foundations theory. And the book he wrote, which I highly recommend, is called The Righteous Mind. And it's all about the differences between liberals and conservatives and why they talk past each other and what you could do about getting people to talk to each other instead. It's a really cool book. I have a group of me and two other guys who get together for lunch every few weeks to talk about politics, and I'm pretty conservative and they're both quite liberal. Mm-hmm. And we have managed to talk to each other and like each other and get to places that you wouldn't necessarily get to. And what our experience on both sides has been, you know, now they have some conservative ideas that they didn't previously have, and I have some more liberal ideas that I didn't previously have. And we all have the experience of, you go to, they tell me they go to their very liberal friends and they mention some of these ideas and the minds immediately snap shut, because, you know, that's just how people are. And I've seen the same thing on my side. But if you get to know each other on kind of a more human level, and this book gives you some guidance about what to look at, then it's possible to make contact across the divide.
Thank you.
Yes.
It sounds like an example of what you speak about in your book, Mark.
It is. And Jonathan is a good friend of mine and somebody who I quote in the book. And he's done something, you know, which, you know, a good thinker, I believe, should do. In fact, he's done something in his book that I think every one of us as citizens need to do, which is to say, hey, there's some good ideas on the left and there's some good ideas on the right. These are like two hands on our body. We have two hands, a right and a left hand. We don't think they should be arguing all day. We use them, you know, every day quite naturally. So, you know, my view is the body is a clue, and Jonathan agrees with this. You know, the body is a clue that says, oh, the right and left are here for a reason. If we can get them to work together rather than against each other, we're probably going to come up with a better solution. And when I say to audiences, you know, how many of you would like to live your life with just one hand, if you had a choice between one hand or two? Well, everybody wants two hands. But for some reason, in politics, we always think, oh, you know, Hillary's got the answer or Donald Trump's got the answer. Well, you know, maybe the Republicans have some wisdom and maybe the Democrats have some wisdom, and that's why they're here. But however, we need a system then that brings out that wisdom, not a system that brings out the worst in us. And I think that's why I appreciate Jonathan's work and why my book, The Reunited States of America, is actually pointing in that direction as well.
Thank you. So how do we get there? The caller mentioned how he gathers with people on the opposite side of the political spectrum.
But on a micro level.
But I sense that so often we live in our own world, so that, you know, people with similar tastes, similar political philosophy gather around and talk to one another. And very seldom do we make the effort or know how to make the effort to cross the political divide. Sometimes even whole communities. So we talk about red states and blue states. Mm-hmm.
How do we get out of our bubbles?
Well, it's interesting you use the word bubble, Celeste.
I did it deliberately.
one of the people I profile in my book is a CEO of a company called AllSides.com, and his name is John Gable, a Republican, and he realized that people were, what he said, basically he noticed people on the right and people on the left were caught in what he called the bias bubble. Mm-hmm. We all walk around in our bias bubble, and so he thought to himself, the Internet is unfortunately kind of reinforcing the bias bubble, because, you know, progressive can go to progressive websites and a conservative can go to conservative websites, and we can keep our little bias bubble getting thicker and thicker. And so he created AllSides.com, which your listeners can go to and see. There's the news from the center perspective, from the right perspective, and from the left perspective every single day. And he thought, if we can create a place where people can get the news from multiple perspectives, they'll start to think for themselves. And I'm really appreciate John, because he's trying to get AllSides.com into America's schools so kids can start to learn, oh, that's what they mean by progressive. Oh, that's what they mean by conservative. Oh, that's what they call, you know, mainstream. Oh, well, what do I think? Which of those makes sense to me? And, of course, you know, by becoming aware of those multiple perspectives, it's very unlikely that generation is going to argue like we do. You know, they're going to say, oh, I'm talking to a person who thinks that way. Well, I'm going to have to, you know, reach out and make sense with this person because we've got different perspectives. I'm really excited about his project, and I hope it succeeds.
So maybe that might be a move, or maybe even a return to a time when, for example, in any town you had multiple newspapers with different political perspectives. Now, that is not so much the case today. So the Internet and a source like this gives the people the opportunity to hear different perspectives, which they may not have because of what Celeste termed, you know, corporate capital media.
I agree completely. And I think a big part of my book is about media that are breaking out of the mold, like AllSides.com, and that are saying, hey, you know, what is our real purpose? And our real purpose is learning. Our real purpose is not confirming what our listeners already believe. Our real purpose is learning together, and that's, I think, as I mentioned earlier, that's what Jefferson wanted. And, you know, he defined a generation as every 19 years. Well, you know, I'm now in my 60s. That means I should have seen American government being reinvented two or three times in my lifetime. And in fact, what I've seen is our government becoming more and more and more stuck during my lifetime, which is why I wrote The Reunited States of America. I think we need to wake up from what I call the partisan trance, and realize all these points of view are here for a reason. And I, by the way, think Oregon is a pioneering state. Some of your listeners are in Oregon. I think Oregon has been a pioneer in testing new ways that lawmakers from different sides of the aisle can work together towards common ground. The country has a lot to learn from Oregon.
You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community connection, KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the metro area, 91.9 in points east along the Columbia River Gorge and in Hood River, Oregon, in Philomath, Oregon, and points south along the Willamette River Valley. It is 104.3, and everywhere it is KBOO.FM. We're speaking with Mark Gurzon, who is the author of The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. And I'm going to hold my question. I have another caller on board, and we want to welcome Mary Ann this morning. Good morning.
Hi, I'm sorry my voice isn't the best. I've got a cold. But Yeah, I just wanted to mention the idea of campaign finance reform, and my position on this is nobody seems to ask this question, what does the money get spent on? And it's primarily television advertising. And that's the problem.
Oh, Marianne, thank you. Because, yes, yeah. Electronics. Go ahead.
Well, it's advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, campaigns, issues, and people should not be advertised. We should have information about them. And I say a good example of this is our local newspaper, Street Roots, that has, at the local level, they interview candidates and they ask them their position on various issues. This is information. It's not advertisement. And if we had... If the media was really doing its job of reporting the news, and campaigns are news, and hopefully if it's good journalism, it's objective, it's not advertising. And if you did that, and if you outlawed advertising, particularly television advertising, you wouldn't need all that money. So that's my point. What we need is campaign reform, not campaign finance reform.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a beautiful point, and it fits in with the theme of this morning's conversation, in that when the founding fathers ran for office, they literally ran for office and rode horseback for office and spoke, you know, in taverns and in churches, you know, face to face, because, you know, there was no way to magnify their voice through the media. The media was basically newspapers and a few little pamphlets. And, you know, it's absolutely true that today that fortune is being spent on advertising, and it's almost to the point now where a candidate could never leave their home and simply broadcast through this multi-billion dollar, you know, advertising. And I think we're going to see a lot of that in the next 6 months. We're going to see both the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign doing billions of dollars of using advertising, essentially, you know, often to lie or at least to distort the truth. And, you know, I couldn't agree more, you know, with your caller's sentiment that that's not what we need. Campaign reform, not just campaign finance reform. But I do feel that money matters, because the reason money makes such a difference is that, you know, one candidate can literally, whether they're their best candidate or not, can blow the other one out of the water by throwing an enormous amount of money into the media in the closing weeks of a campaign. And it totally distorts the campaign process, and the founding fathers would have hated it.
So let me ask a question then, Mark. I want to go back and reference something that we both talked about, and that was the face-to-face conversations and how important they are. And my assertion that maybe that's what they left us is the dynamic of face-to-face conversations. So to look at the older mode of campaigning, you had your literally standing on a stump speech, you had your whistle stops, you had all of that where people got up and they spoke sometimes for hours so they could dialogue with people and they could speak at length and deliver a more developed plan for addressing whatever points were brought up. And people then would report on that, but somebody actually had to be in attendance and then come back and write about it. So you had people being able to discuss it. Even if they couldn't read the paper, they could hear it. How can we raise that micro level of the living room conversations, or the conversations like one of our earlier callers mentioned with, you know, getting some different minded people together? How can we raise that to a higher level and maybe get it done at a state level, a local level, or just something so that maybe the pressure from below pushes up?
Well, I think, you know, you're really raising the question of civic engagement and the
yes.
question of what's happened to citizens and their power. And I think if you want pressure from the bottom up, citizens will have to kind of remember why we're citizens, why we're not, you know, subjects like we were in the monarchy. And we're citizens because, you know, the power was supposed to be in our hands. Right. What's happening now, though, I believe, is that the political parties, against the best advice of the founding fathers, the political parties now look like they have most of the power. So most of the listeners to this show, like myself, you know, we realize that if we want to have any impact on American politics, we think, well, Am I going to do it through the Republican Party or the Democratic Party? Well, again, that wasn't what the Founding Fathers intended. They didn't intend that we would turn into two factions, and that those factions would become institutionalized, and those factions would have leaders, and those leaders would have, of those two parties, would have all the power. And yet that's what happened. I'll just give you one illustration. You know, there's a very active League of Women Voters in Oregon. Well, the National League of Women Voters used to run the presidential debates.
Right.
It was actually an organization of Republican and Democratic women who ran the debates and decided how they were structured and who was going to moderate them and when they were going to be on television. And that was true until 1984. And in 1984, the Democratic and Republican parties both got to the point where they were so kind of aggressive and so determined to take advantage of that election that they started treating the League of Women Voters in so shabbily that, according to my conversation with the former president of the League of Women Voters, you know, they just basically had to say, look, we can't deal with these two political parties. They're treating us in such a dirty and aggressive way that we have to let go of this thing. And, of course, when they let go of it, you know who took it over, the Democratic and Republican parties.
Right.
And now the Presidential Debate Commission is totally controlled by those two parties. The Federal Election Commission is totally controlled by those two parties. And yet we say we live in a democracy where we citizens have power. Well, we do, but our power is being mediated by and muted by these two gigantic enterprises called these two parties. So that's part of why I say we need to wake up from a partisan trance. And if we really want a reunited States of America rather than a divided States of America, we are going to have to stand up against the Democratic and Republican Party takeover of key institutions that were supposed to be in the people's hands. And I'll give you one other example. I mean, in the state election, in the election that's coming up, you know, you'd like to think that, you know, just like in a football game or a basketball game, the referees are neutral. Well, the referees in politics aren't neutral. The Secretary of State, who runs the election in the state, is a member of a Democratic or Republican Party. And while they're supposed to be fairly managing that campaign, that electoral process, they're at the same time, you know, a loyal Democrat or Republican. So that's another reform that I talk about in the book, the need to develop an independent, neutral campaign structure, electoral structure that, you know, isn't already part of one of the two parties' systems.
So go ahead, Cecil.
Let me ask you in terms of, again, in asking about reforms that you opened up, two things, and you can take them how you may want. You talked about the control the Republicans and Democratic parties hold. One of the concerns of many people is that they don't have a say in who will be the political candidate. So there has been a call, and in some states, independents are able to vote in the primary they decide to choose, either Democrat or Republican. So would that be a good move in terms of opening up the primary process to all voters?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question is in terms of just general, in terms of how effective nonpartisan elections are. So in local elections, many elections are nonpartisan, or so they claim, but you still have people divided up in terms of certain interests. So can we get beyond partisanship? And the first question was in terms of state primaries.
Yes, well, it's one of the most important civil rights issues of our time, that independent voters in many states, you know, they can't vote in the Democratic Party primary, they can't vote in the Republican primary, and independents are roughly 42% of the American people. And now the millennials who are listening to you, millennials are 55-60% independents. So what that means is that, you know, from 40-60% of Americans in many states are excluded from that primary process. So they, when election day comes, they have to pick between two candidates that were picked by two minority groups in their states. And that's clearly not what the Founding Fathers intended. I personally believe that independents are the great hope of the future, because independents are people who, for whatever reason, they might be liberal, they might be conservative, but for whatever reason, they've said, I'm not going to outsource my independence, my freedom, to the Democratic or Republican Party. I'm a human being with complicated personal views on most issues, and I want to be able to think for myself. I'm not going to delegate my thinking to one party or the other. So I think this reform is absolutely essential, and that open primaries is the wave of the future. It's now, I think, in 13 states and spreading rapidly, and it has to happen because it literally is we've been disenfranchised. You know, we all are think it was horrible that African American voters were not allowed to vote. Well, now 42% of the American people in many states are not allowed to vote because they're independents.
And then with regard to, there was a second question
about nonpartisan elections. Are they effective in getting beyond the political divide?
I believe they are. I believe they are, and I think we're seeing them spread to different states as well. And I think that's partly what one of the organizations that I profile in my book called IndependentVoter.org. I really recommend that many of your listeners go to IndependentVoter.org, and you'll meet some folks who are working on these issues in a very, very determined way, and are actually organizing protests in states across the country. To create exactly the kind of reforms that we're talking about.
So now, with regard to something that you said earlier, the fact that there has been a diminishing amount of people who are able and or eligible to vote, I know that there have been some spastic efforts nationally to ensure the right to vote, and that some states are rescinding whatever prohibitions they have against people who have served time such to reinstate them to the rights of voting. What else can we look at in terms of creating less partisanship and ensuring that more people are able to vote?
Well, it's interesting. Every subject that we bring up, I'm noticing, comes back to the same question, which is, you know, can we get people from different political perspectives to solve problems, whether it's, you know, enfranchising voters or the campaign finance issue earlier or changing the open primaries. In every one of these cases, you know, what I find is that people have their pet issue, you know, like, you know, access to the voting booth or, you know, campaign finance reform or open primaries or getting money out of politics. And the truth is that for any of those changes to happen, we have to change our attitude towards problem solving. And the third chapter of my book is called From Position Taking to Problem Solving. Because if you think that being a political leader or a politically active citizen is about arguing for your position, and that's what being politically active means, and of course people on the other side, if they think arguing for their position is what being politically active means, all you're going to have is two positions arguing with each other and nothing happens. And for me, you know, the key question I ask is, are you more interested in being right and having your position be proven right, or are you more interested in solving the problem? So whether it's the issue you just raised, Celeste, or any of the other ones that have come up, you know, my feeling is that's the fundamental shift we need. And if people's kids go to the same school, they will have to work through their attitudes towards education or guns or a number of other issues. If their kids go to the same school, they share a common denominator. But when people call into a radio show, or when people go to the voting booth, or when people think about a national election, they don't think in terms of their kids going to the same school with people on the other side. They think of those people on the other side as being people they're against. And we've got to get back to that community feeling of realizing, it's as if all of our kids went to the same school. If we want our schools to be safer or schools to be better, we have to think in terms of being neighbors, not in terms of being enemies.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. My co-host is Celeste Carey. I am Cecil Prescott. We're speaking with Mark Gertzen, author of The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. And before we go to our next caller, let me remind you that coming up at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Locust Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Jennifer Ackerman, author of The Genius of Birds, about birds' impressive skills and behavior. At 11 on Health Watch, host David Naiman speaks with Dr. Michael Mosley about his book, The 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet. At 11:30, we remember Oregon writer Catherine Dunn with excerpts from program in the KBOO archives, Between the Covers and Gremlin Time. Hey, thank you, all KBOO members, for supporting us during our spring membership drive. You made it quite a success. Let's go to Tim. Thank
Good
you,
morning.
Tim.
Good morning, Tim.
Hi.
You're on there?
My comment was is that I think the other alternative to changing everything is just that Bernie Sanders and probably Donald Trump both should have ran as independents instead of running as part of parties that they don't really belong to.
Wait a minute. Say that again, please, Tim. I kind of got confused with the last part of what you said.
Oh, I feel that Bernie Sanders and probably also Donald Trump should have ran as independents instead of Republicans and Democrats because they don't really fall into those categories or parties.
So could you expand a little bit? Why should they have run as independents? Would they have been more successful? Were they?
I think, well, I know, I really feel that Bernie Sanders would probably be elected president if he would have ran as an independent.
Now,
instead of being bullied around by the Democratic Party and trying to get Hillary Clinton to go along with his points of view. He would have just been saying his points of view, and they all would have been trailing in the polls the whole time. And
okay.
That's my personal opinion.
Okay, thank
all
you.
All right, thank you for your comment.
So certainly independent parties have been around. People have run independent campaign. I think most recently, most successful was Ross Perot in 92-96. Is that a route that that might be successful in achieving transformation of our politics, Mark?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to the caller's point of view, and I'm sure a lot of Sanders and Trump supporters wish their candidates were free from the party structures. But the fact that they're running as Democrats and Republicans underscores what I've said, mm-hmm. That most candidates realize today, if you're not part of one of these two teams, you're basically out of the picture. And there's really no way to play the game unless you climb up one of those two ladders. And, we're a country of 350 million people. We have lots and lots of different points of views. Even in our own families, we know we have lots of different points of views. So the idea that, you have to play those two games is, I think, part of the problem. Now, just starting an independent party, as your caller suggests, is a little naive, because at the moment, that party would then have to play by the rules set by the Democratic and Republican parties.
Right.
And what very few people know is that over the last 20 years, the Democratic and Republican parties have quietly and steadily changed the rules by which you become an independent candidate, about how you get on the ballot, about how many signatures you need to get on the ballot, about what it costs to do X, Y, and Z. And basically, if you look into the details, it all boils down to the same thing, which is they've made it harder and harder and harder for anyone to run as independent candidate. So,
I think is not their power. That really should belong to the people.
Exactly, exactly. So I'm very sympathetic to the caller's desire to see an independent voice, but part of what we're dealing with is that the Democratic and Republican parties have taken powers that, Constitution says, literally, this is a quote from the Constitution, powers not reserved for the federal government will be allocated to the states and to the people. So they say if the federal government doesn't have the power, either the state of Oregon should have it or you and I should have it. And that's not the way most people are experiencing it, including Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. They realized, I want to be president. Well, I've got to play one of these two games. And, in the case of Bernie Sanders, he was literally an independent senator from Vermont, calling himself an independent for most of his career. And Donald Trump was a businessman who, as he proudly says, gave money to Democrats and Republicans, both right and left, to get what he wanted. So we have two very independent souls. And even they decided, okay, I better run one of these two ways.
One to two ways, and that's the cards we are dealt with. And so what you try to do is help us examine to getting beyond that. Speaking of those two candidates, I also note that you write a column on occasion for the Huffington Post. And so as we decide on our elections, we have to decide on candidates to vote for. In a recent column, You reference a book you wrote about 10 years ago, Leading Through Conflicts, How Successful Leaders Transform Differences into Opportunities. And you talk about leadership qualities, and you know, which candidates get a perfect score, I think was how they entitle it. And I thought it was interesting because I have not had the chance to read your earlier book, but there are certain leadership styles that people might think of in terms of looking at leaders. Is that correct?
That's right. And I talk in Leading Through Conflict about the demagogue style, the manager style, and the mediator style. Mm-hmm. And the demagogue style is the style that's basically become, you know, the current model of leadership. The demagoguery is really about taking whatever you want to talk about and creating a them, creating somebody you're totally, you know, want to paint as the devil. In the, you know, Hitler did it using the Jews, of course, and wrap everything around being against them and how they are this threat to the country, and you then position yourself as the savior because they are out to destroy America. And, you know, Donald Trump does that 100%, and Bernie Sanders does that 60%, and almost all candidates do that more than they ever have before. Because, again, just look at CNN or Fox or most of the networks. If you call somebody a name, you will be on the news the next night. The uglier the name, the ruder and cruder the statement you make, the more press you're going to get. So the demagogue style, I think, is a sign of a country going into crisis. And, yes, that's why I wrote that column about who gets the perfect score and looked at why, you know, Donald Trump gets a perfect score on the demagogue scale that I wrote about in 2006. So I wasn't personally attacking him, and I'm not personally attacking anybody in my comments. I'm just saying 10 years ago, I studied closely the qualities of the demagogue, and some of our candidates this year fit that profile perfectly.
And so as we look at this political season, and it will get even more intense during the fall, what are some of your suggestions on how citizens should conduct themselves? What should they look for? How can they make this an opportunity in which to help create a better democracy?
Well, two things. The closing chapter of the United States of America gives sort of a little checklist of specific things that citizens can do. So I recommend readers look at the last chapter of the United States of America, but I also encourage them to go to bridgealliance.us. And if they go to bridgealliance.us, they will find 40 organizations, many of which are active in their own communities. And in those 40 organizations, they will find an amazing set of practical things they can do. And one of the people who helped us found the BridgeAlliance.us is sitting right in Portland today. Her name's Debbie Lynn Molyneux, and it'll probably be Debbie Lynn who answers people's calls. And the Bridge Alliance is a one-stop shop because it's not one organization saying, please join us. It's actually a network of 40 organizations, including the ones I've mentioned in this show, Living Room Conversations and National Institute of Civil Discourse. And a lot of the organizations that are active are members of the Bridge Alliance. And we founded the Bridge Alliance so that people could easily have one place to go to find out, how can I get involved? So those are two practical ways, Cecil. And I'd also encourage people to listen to your show and educate themselves and keep learning. You know, keep learning and do what one of our callers did, which is form a little group, whether it's a living room group or a readers group or a book group. Make sure there are people from across the divide who are part of your small group, and learn to model in your own community what our politicians ultimately need to learn, which is, you know, how to work together to solve the problems that we face.
Well, we are certainly thankful for you taking the time this morning and sharing with us and our listeners your wisdom and your experience. And I want to encourage all people not only to make connections with those websites and organizations you referenced this morning, but also pick up a copy of your book, Mark Goertzen, The Reunited States of America. So thank you so much for your work. And as we leave, are you hopeful about the future?
I'm very hopeful about the future of our culture, because change usually happens in the culture. And I think if the change happens in the culture, as it already is, we'll see change happening ultimately in our politics. That's what's happened in countries around the world. It starts with our culture. It starts with our values. And then finally, the politicians say, hey, things are changing. I better change with them.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. You have a great day. And to our listeners, you have been listening to More Talk Radio with Celeste Carey. My name is Cecil Prescott. Have a great day.
Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The 29th annual festival takes place this year from July 1st through 4th and includes performers like the Tedeschi Truck Band, Jimmy Vaughn and the Tilt-A-Whirl Band, Samantha Fish, and many, many more. Festival passes are on sale at early bird prices until May 31st. More information about the festival performers, the options for passes, and other information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All African People's Revolutionary Union.